In October of 2017, this counterintelligence officer and trained special agent by the name of Luis Elizondo stepped out of the shadowed halls of the Pentagon and into the public spotlight. Whether he intended it or not, by doing so, he would become an instant celebrity to UFO enthusiasts for saying something that would soon shake the entire world.
For nearly the last decade, I ran a sensitive aerospace threat identification program focusing on unidentified aerial technologies. It was in this position I learned that the phenomenon is indeed real.
Within minutes of speaking these words, the Black Vault used this once insider information to file numerous Freedom of Information Act requests to see what documents could be dug up. The idea was that in the eyes of the law, if this former government agent was talking about it, then the documents may just be ripe for the picking if one were to ask for them. So that's exactly what I did. This unfolding saga brought me hope that after more than 20 years of pushing for the truth, the veil of secrecy surrounding the UFO phenomenon might just be lifting once and for all, and things were drastically changing. Evidence of that change was revealed just 2 months after Elizondo stepped foot on that stage. That is when the mainstream media covered Elizondo, along with his story, and it became a viral sensation all over the world.
Out front now, the former Pentagon military official who ran the covert government program up until this last November, Luis Elizondo. Luis, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Until he stepped out on stage last October alongside rock star Tom DeLonge and other former government insiders, most of the world had never heard of Luis Elizondo, which is how he liked it.
But as excitement exploded worldwide about this secret Pentagon UFO study known as the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, or ATIP, controversy had already begun to percolate inside the Black Vault about what was really going on. Just 3 weeks prior to the New York Times running their now world-famous headline, the Pentagon told the Black Vault they had no records on any program that Elizondo had described. Not a single piece of evidence whatsoever. A couple months after that, the Navy denied they gave anything to the ATIP program, despite what Elizondo had claimed. And then, just months after that, the Pentagon issued a statement that was the most damning of all. They claimed that Elizondo had no assigned responsibilities on the ATIP program that he had brought into the spotlight. As the months and years passed since the initial headlines, the Black Vault became highly critical of Elizondo's claims. This is not a popular stance to take, and as social media can easily prove, that type of stance can come with a little bit of heat. But it wasn't just Elizondo on the receiving end of criticism. The Pentagon and the entire U.S. government has had a history of covering up UFO data for decades. And it appeared that's exactly what they may be doing again. But to what extent? My guest today is the man who started it all, Luis Elizondo himself. Despite the Black Vault's criticism, and admittedly the nitpicking of every single detail in order to find the absolute truth, Elizondo has agreed to step into the vault and share his side of the story in a special one-on-one interview. Stay tuned. You're about to journey inside the Black Vault. That's right, everybody. As always, thank you so much for tuning in and making this your podcast or your live stream of choice. I'm your host, John Greenwald Jr. And to say that I am, well, beyond excited about the next hour or so, that would be an understatement. I've been looking forward to doing this with my guest, doing a sit down for quite some time now, I guess approaching probably about 3 years. And he has been nothing
but gracious and a gentleman, despite my high criticism and my skepticism about some things that have come out. I don't want to waste any time. I want to bring on to the show Mr. Luis Elizondo. I really, on behalf of everybody watching and listening, thank you for taking the time today to talk to all of us.
Well, John, thank you. I appreciate it very much. I certainly appreciate your audience as well. And I don't say this frivolously, and I've told you this before privately. You have managed to do things in this arena that very few other individuals have ever been able to accomplish, particularly your work in FOIA. For those who may not know, FOIA Freedom of Information Act was enacted in order to ensure transparency for the American public into government workings, if you will, because in the past there had been some issues with that, where the government may have overstepped its authorities, and as a result, so Congress enacts FOIA process. And I think there has probably never been anybody who has been as savvy in the FOIA process than you. So thank you also for what you do. It's sincerely appreciated. I know not just for folks like me, but on behalf of everybody out there, your work over the past few decades really has been pretty incredible.
I really appreciate those kind words. And as my audience is already seeing, and I'll say it again, despite that skepticism from me, you have always been that gentleman and a scholar. You've always been open to me. You've spoken to me on the telephone, and now you're doing this. But I want to return that respect to you, and I hope everybody realizes that. I've tried to say that on social media, but also the fact that you're here, and I want this as kind of a housekeeping note for those listening and watching. I ask all my guests this, and all of them can attest to it. However, I did ask the same question to you, which was, is there anything you don't want me to go into? And you have never once told me, even though I've asked you, I've quadruple checked that through the last few months as we've set this up, you've never once said, nope, don't go here, nope, don't go there. You've always said the same thing, which was everything's on the table. So my respect to you for that and for being here. And let's just kind of jump right into it. What I want to do and how I structured this interview is essentially take a chronological look at some of maybe some stuff that you've already talked about, but also filling in the holes. Some questions may be a little bit sensitive. We might get into some areas where you go, sorry, John, I ain't going to talk to you about that. And so I'll apologize in advance if I start pushing those buttons. But that's who I am. I have to push them. So take me back to the beginning, if you could, on how you became involved in ATIP and exactly how that came to be.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. But before I do that, John, let me also offer one mea culpa and apology also to you. And I'm not sure that we really ever had a chance to address this. But the bottom line is that years ago, I try to make myself as approachable as possible. And years ago, I know several years ago, you tried to reach out and try to have a conversation with me. And unfortunately, that message never got to me. And I want to apologize because I do think we should have probably had this conversation 3 years ago. And probably every year after that as well. And because that information never got to me, unfortunately, we never gave you a reply, a response that you deserved. And so I want to say here and now, I'm really, really sorry. We never had a chance to do this earlier. I think this conversation is a long time coming, and I really do appreciate sincerely your patience thus far. I promise you it was not intentional on my part. I just never knew you had even inquired to speak with me until after, you know, we actually had talked the first time and you had said, hey, Lou, I've been trying to get a hold of you for, you know, X amount of months. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea. So I want to apologize here, you know, on air, just so you know, that was never intentional.
Well, I appreciate that. No, somebody taught me a long time ago, you don't know what you don't know, and there's no need to apologize, but accept it anyway. But I appreciate you pointing that out. Thank you.
So back to ATIP, how did I get involved? Let's rewind the clock to about 2008, and I'll give you kind of the synopsis of how all this evolved. I was working prior to that at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. I was a senior intelligence officer working policy, strategy, things like that. And to be quite frankly, frank with you, the drive was killing me. I was living on Maryland's Eastern Shore at the time, and you're looking at a 3-hour commute one way. I loved my job. I loved the people, but the commute was killing me. So at the time, it was then Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, Jim Clapper, was over at the USDI, and he was the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence at the time, and a man I respected greatly. And I was given an opportunity to come back to DOD for about a year to work some new efforts, particularly in intelligence sharing, law enforcement, information integration. And so I came back very eager because my daily commute was cut about in half all of a sudden. And I had my a little bit more of my life back. So I went back to DOD. And it was at that time I was working in the National Capital Region, NCR region, where some people had come to my desk. We were working. I wasn't in the Pentagon at the time. We were working at a remote location, but still connected to the Pentagon. You know, it's kind of bizarre because you're like out of a movie. These two people, I still remember today very clearly from what they were wearing, very nicely dressed. I remember someone knocking on the door and said, "Mr. Elizondo, there's some people here to see you," which is not uncommon. You know, you're always working issues, so you're trying to fix things. So sure, bring them on in. They came in and they said, "Hey, you're Luis Elizondo." And I said, "Yes, I am Lou. Can we talk to you?" And I said, "Sure." And one of them shut the door behind them, my door. I'm like, okay, this is probably not good. You know, I often joke, you know, what did I do now, right? I probably upset somebody. And they sat down and they started to say, you know, "Hey, look, we are part of the intelligence community. We're part of a program. We're not going to tell you much about it, but do you mind telling us a little bit about yourself?" And I probably was a little rude. I probably was a little bit standoffish because I don't particularly like talking about myself, especially if I don't know who you are. And they started asking very pointed questions. So specifically about, you know, "We hear that you're a counterintelligence guy. We hear that you did some background before. You have some background in advanced avionics and aerospace industry. Is that true? And yes, do you mind sharing with us?" I said, "Well, I'll share with you at the unclassified level the type of systems I worked on, but I'm really not comfortable going into any more detail." And so long story short, they agreed to they would come back and have another discussion with me. And so when they left, I ran some trap lines to find out that they were legit. They were part of a special program, but I didn't have clearance into it, so I really didn't know. But they really were who they said they were. They were part of a small organization. And I presumed at the time it had something to do with aerospace, but I really didn't know. And then a couple more trips, they came by, we talked, got a little bit more comfortable. They got more comfortable with me. I certainly got more comfortable with them. And finally, they said, "We'd like to have you meet our director." And I said, "Okay, sure, no problem." It might have been, John, probably 7 or 10 days later, I had an appointment to go meet. I was hoping the director would come see me. Mm-hmm. I thought I was sufficiently senior enough where, you know, you want to come see me, you can come see me. Instead, they're like, "Okay, be at this location at this time at this place and don't tell anybody you're coming." So again, a little bit unusual. I'm like, you know, "I'm sorry, who are you?" Mm-hmm. So I decided to go ahead and do it. And I told my deputy at the time, "Hey, I'm going to go to this meeting." I went to it. And it was at an undisclosed location in also the National Capital Region. Looked a bit just like a normal office building, really, until you go inside. And then you realize that you have, you know, guards and whatnot. And you're like, "Okay, no, this is probably a little bit more sensitive." I remember going up the elevator up to the floor, and it looked like an office building you would see like on Wall Street, really. You know, cubicles all over the place and people kind of making copies and doing work diligently on their computers. And there was this corner office, kind of looked like glass, you know, and the individual sitting back in there. And what struck me is that the individual was, I don't want to stereotype, but if you would ever think of what a rocket scientist looks like, he was your quintessential rocket scientist. Mm-hmm. Glasses, you know, very, very, appeared very astute and very no nonsense. So I went, I introduced myself, shook his hand, "Hey, glad you're here." He didn't smile. He was just very serious. And he was, man, he looked at me, he was staring at me. I felt almost a little uncomfortable because I know he was assessing the hell out of me. And I was trying to assess him as well, but obviously, he probably knew a little bit more about me than I knew about him. which is never really good to go into a meeting like that as an intelligence officer. You know, you kind of want to, if you will, know thy enemy. Not saying he was my enemy by any stretch, but, you know, you want to know who you're dealing with. And he introduced himself. And I'm sure at some point his name will become very public. I have, out of respect for him, I've never mentioned his name. He's asked me never to mention it until he's comfortable with his name being out, so I won't. But we talked. We had a very good, candid conversation, and that's when he asked me. I mean, he started asking me about my background in aerospace and the type of technologies I worked on. And you know, this is a guy who he knew his stuff. I mean, he was like literally by definition, a rocket scientist, mm-hmm. and probably one of the best ones that we had in the government. And that's when, you know, he asked me, he said, what do you think about, John, he looked him straight in the face, and looking back, it was so weird because I wasn't sure if he was like testing me or if it was legit, but he said, what do you think about the topic of UFOs? Now, coming from my world, you know, to test somebody, we will use provocative statements sometimes and then gauge their body language and, you know, microbehaviors and neurolinguistics, mm-hmm. To see if, you know, they're prone to, you know, flights of fancy and things like that, you know. And, but he was looking at me very serious. And I said, well, I don't really think about UFOs. And he says, what, you don't think they're real? I said, no, I didn't say that. I never really had the luxury to think about UFOs. You know, I'm not particularly a huge science fiction fan. I never really watched X-Files or anything like that. And I've been so consumed with my work that when I'm not working, I'm at home and I'm a father. But those are really the only things I ever have time for, work and which didn't involve mm-hmm. anything at all involving UFOs, clearly, and raising a family. So he said, okay, that's fair. And he said, but let me just caution you, that don't let your analytic bias get in the way. And he said, you're gonna see things that you may have a hard time reconciling. Now, at this mm-hmm. point, I hadn't even accepted it. I hadn't been offered even really a job, right?
So yeah.
I'm thinking to myself, is this a pitch? Are you offering me a job? Is this just advice for life, you know, to take with me? And what the hell's really going on here? So I nodded my head and said, no, you know, very, very fair point, right? I don't really have an opinion yet on it. And then we agreed, had another conversation, but he said, look, I'm looking for a counterintelligence guy. For those in your audience who may not know what really counterintelligence is, and a lot of people think they know what CI is. CI is really... knowing what the enemy knows about you, right? So foreign intelligence collection is learning what the bad guys know. Counterintelligence is knowing what the bad guys know about you. So if you think of a chessboard, mm-hmm. If you are playing chess against an opponent, you know, foreign intelligence is knowing what their pieces can do on the chessboard and how they plan to move. Counterintelligence is knowing what they know about your pieces, right? And how you can move. So it's yet another layer of playing chess to some degree, I guess. You know, not any better or worse than other forms of intelligence. It's a very niche way of doing business from an intelligence perspective. So he said, I'm looking for a counterintelligence guy because we know that there are some foreign countries, foreign adversaries out there that probably know what we're doing. And I need a good counterintelligence and security program, which, by the way, it's not unusual. Anytime you have a sensitive program, you know, you want to have good security and counterintelligence expertise. It's just an extra layer of, if you will, insurance mm-hmm. to protect your program. So it wasn't unusual that I was being asked to provide counterintelligence expertise. I wasn't being asked to do anything with UFOs per se. It was just to come in and provide, you know, the background that I already have, just use that in this capacity. So ultimately, long story short, obviously the rest is history. No pun intended. I said, sure, I'll accept the job. And it was at that point, through various conversations afterwards, I began to realize that these guys are legit. They're real. I mean, they have like real data. And the individuals that they started that were part of this effort, I knew from before, like people like Hal Puthoff and whatnot, that were, you know, they were kind of legends in their own time anyways. So I knew this was a serious, legitimate effort. And then I began to see the documentation from the Senate and Congress. And I really began to recognize that this was a full-fledged program, but they really did need counterintelligence expertise. They didn't have anything. So they were kind of vulnerable from that perspective. Yeah, I know it's probably a long-winded explanation.
No, that's okay. I appreciate it because I want the groundwork here. Now, in this next question, I want you to kind of clarify. You can do it quickly if you could. The difference between what we learned of the advanced aerospace weapons. Now I'm drawing a blank. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. The OSAP program. Then I get tongue-tied versus the program that you joined that you just described, the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, or ATIP. What was the difference between the two? Because this has been an area of much confusion, not only by myself, but it seems like those that even worked on the program, which I'll explain in a moment.
Absolutely. Not only you, but I mean, honestly, probably to all of us to some degree in the beginning. So in the very beginning days, there was very little difference between OSAP and ATIP. There really wasn't a clear line distinction. There were focuses of the same effort. And what it was, you had portions of OSAP, which of course now know Bigelow Aerospace was part of, had some incredible scientists working it at the ranch facility. And by the way, other places, it wasn't just the ranch.
Just to clarify, you're talking about Skinwalker Ranch.
I am.
Okay. Yeah. So you're, and this is another one, but since you brought it up, I'll just ask it really quick. So ATIP or OSAP or both operated on the grounds of Skinwalker Ranch in Utah.
I want to be careful. I don't want to answer for Bob Bigelow or the former director of the program, because those are probably nuances you'd have to ask them. Okay. I will say that it involved the ranch. OSAP was that it was looking at the phenomenon through a very broad lens. That's what they were doing.
Okay.
And by the way, there was some pretty compelling data. I'll share with you that there was some very compelling data. Some of it was a little bit disturbing, to be honest with you. But in 2009, the decision was really made to formally, if you will, partition off that part of the study involving the UAP phenomena under ATIP. And the reason why is because we were getting data from all different sensor platforms that weren't necessarily ranch related. These were, you know, of course, everybody now knows Nimitz and all these other cases. But you know, you had, you know, strategic carrier groups out in certain AORs, areas of operation, if you will, where we were picking up UAP activity. And so we realized that there was a concerted need to focus on the topic of UAPs from a nuts and bolts perspective. Now, let me caveat, a lot of people, when I say that, they kind of retract and say, yeah, but you can't look at these from a nuts and bolts perspective. You have to, you know, look at this from this perspective and that perspective. And you know what, they could be absolutely right. But in the Department of Defense, we had to be able to do two things, and that's qualify and quantify data. Otherwise, for us, it was useless. I'm not saying it is useless. I'm saying for our purposes, in Department of Defense briefing senior leadership, that unless I can qualify and quantify data, it's conjecture. Mm-hmm. There's no there. I can't do anything with it. So, and there was enough sufficient data coming in where we could. I mean, we could say there were these many incidents occurring in this particular month in these particular parts of the waters with these particular assets. You know, these are the videos or pictures that were taken and radar information. And so it helps you paint a compelling picture to leadership of an event that is occurring or events that are occurring. And so that decision really started to solidify in 2009. And that's why you see, I think, in Senator Reid's now infamous letter that came out, everybody now knows about, all the way back in 2009 to then Deputy Secretary Lynn, that he wanted to take this portion of ATIP, this, you actually see the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, become a formalized effort and put that into SAP channels to protect it. Because we knew, based upon the efforts that were going on with OSAP, that you had two camps. You had some people that really supported the effort, And then you had some people that really didn't support the effort. And by the way, this isn't just with OSAP. We saw this before with Hal Pudoff's program with Stargate and the remote viewing program, that, you know, anytime the government was dealing with something that was maybe a bit unconventional,
fringe,
it would tend to by some fringe, it ruffled a lot of feathers. And I guess the solution then, the mindset was, let's take this program that's kind of exposed and let's put it under this umbrella of SAP where we can protect it. And, you know, we can still continue to collect the information without fear of people on the outside not understanding what we're doing and having this knee-jerk reaction to, just shut it down. So that's kind of how that all evolved.
Gotcha. So then OSAP, from what it sounds like, was completely different. ATIP was branching off on just UAP investigations. Fair to say
from my perspective, I mean, I'm sure if you talk to people that were in OSAP that were still doing stump stuff in the ATIP side of the house and vice versa, they would probably tell you it was more of a gray area. There wasn't really a hard, in the early days, in the end there was, but in the early days, there wasn't really a hard transition, or if you will, an event horizon separating the OSAP program and the ATIP. There was kind of a blurry line there that sometimes shifted. But by 2010, we were firmly, by 2010, nine really, but in 10, there was no question about it. ATIP was its own focus area.
I want to ask you about some of the public documentation, the verified information that has come out. And that is involving OSAP. Now, I know that you didn't lead OSAP, and sometimes you don't like to talk about it, but I do want to ask you something that also encompasses ATIP, which is that public documentation has absolutely zero mention of paranormal, UFOs, UAPs, unidentified craft, and so on, that rather it was more of a forward-looking program. At least that's what the public bid solicitation stated. Where I have a very big question on this is that disconnect from what we know to then Bass getting the contract. It's a UAP study, and then that bores out ATIP, and voila, we have the rest is history. What am I missing just by looking at that documentation?
Yeah. So that's a great question. So anytime you look at any governmental solicitation, we call these contract solicitation, this goes out to the public sphere, right? And that means anybody and everybody can look at it, to include Russians, because it's a contract. You're spending American taxpayer dollars to do job XYZ. So even when you want to build a B-2 bomber, right, in Air Force contracts, you don't put out a contract saying, hey, we want somebody to come out and build a super secret technology. Let me repeat that again. Sorry about that. Even when you're doing the B-2 bomber and you want to do a solicitation for someone to build you a super secret stealth bomber, right? You don't, in the solicitation, it will never say that. It will say very nebulous, ambiguous language, because you don't want to tip off to your foreign adversaries key technology that you're trying to develop or build. So it's the same thing with this. When the solicitation, which, by the way, for the record, I wasn't part of.
Sure.
But I can tell you from general perspective how we do this. At the unclassified level, you're going to see these solicitations always very generalized. And that is specifically because you don't want to tip your hand unnecessarily to your foreign adversaries that you're working on project A, B, C, or D.
Sure.
And so that's why you see it. I would challenge anybody in your audience to go ahead and look at other solicitations. You know, now we can look back and look back 10, 15 years. Look at some of those technologies back then that we were really protecting, whether it's drone technology, right, to help us on the global war on terror. Those solicitations, when you read those unclassified solicitations, almost read nothing like the classified portion of what the job really is. You, in fact, when you look at it, you're going to see, you know, I've read this solicitation six times. I still have no idea what it's for.
So
ambiguous in general.
And let me jump in there, because I get a lot of heat for bringing this up, and I don't think it's as bad of an quote-unquote accusation. I'm not accusing anybody, but I don't think it's as bad of a thing as people make it sound like when I pose this. But if there's a classified portion of a bid solicitation, right, and you have that public setting, and then you have something behind the scenes that only cleared personnel can see when contractors come in, mm-hmm. I'm with you on all of that. However, in kind of digging into that area, where I get myself into trouble from some people, is that Bigelow Aerospace, who obviously has a vested interest in this, personal interest, has invested a lot of his own money away from ATIP and OSAP and all that into the UAP phenomena. If he's not right up front getting that classified description, he sees the public part, they bid on it. What are the odds that that organization gets this contract to secretly, in a classified setting, investigate UAPs? And according to the Defense Intelligence Agency, he's the only one out of every government contractee that contractor that could actually bid on this. He's the only one. And that leads to a discussion about a sweetheart deal. I doubt you want to comment on that. But I bring it up just simply because that's the disconnect that I still don't understand, because he can't grab that classified portion of the solicitation, or correct me if I'm wrong, before he gets granted the contract, right?
Well, I can't comment on it because I wasn't there, sure. But I can comment on it from the perspective of a couple things. So first of all, I do know Mr. Bigelow personally. He's an amazing human being. Anybody who's never had the chance to meet this guy, he really is an American hero. He has contributed more to this topic behind the scenes, I think, than just about anybody. Certainly more than I have. So that's the first thing. Second of all, I think if you look at aerospace in general, look at Lockheed Martin, look at Boeing, look at Northrop Grumman and all these others, you know, there's only certain companies that can build an F-22, right? And at the end of the day, it's up to two companies. I think you had Lockheed, and then you had, you know, the other guys that they wind up going with. A lot of times there are contracts where you might tell somebody ahead of time, look, we're going to write this contract. You're probably the only company that can do it. So just be advised that this contract may be coming out at some point, because there's only certain companies that can do certain things. You wouldn't expect, for example, look at the early days when we had Jeep. I'm a Jeep guy, right? So I love old war Jeeps, Korean War, World War II Jeeps. A lot of people don't realize, people look at a Jeep and say, oh, that was a Jeep product. But there were a lot of companies that were making Jeeps in the early days of World War II. You had Ford making them. And then you had, of course, the Overland Jeep Overland Company. And you had some other organization that were bidding for a contract. And at the end of the day, it turned out to be only two companies, from my understanding, that actually got the Jeep contract. Mm-hmm. And then later it wound up being just one, believe it or not. It's a bit convoluted the way that contracting world works. It's not perfect, but at the same time, I think there's enough oversight now. When you look at how contracts are selected, they're not selected by anybody who's connected really to the contract. They're connected by an outside independent organization. And there's a reason for that, because you have to be fair and unbiased. Now, I don't know this to be true, but I've been told that apparently Bigelow Bass was the only one to actually bid for the contract. So, you know, naturally, if you only have one bidder and they have the qualifications, they're probably going to get the contract. But I unfortunately, like I said, occurred before my time.
Sure.
I came in really in 2008. That ship had sailed back in 2007. So I truly, honestly can't tell you exactly how it went down, only because I wasn't there for it.
I got you. Fair enough. During the ATIP days, I want to talk a little bit about the controversy. We're about halfway through the interview, and I want to make sure that I give you ample time to address some of this. And that is the government's reaction to you coming out. You resign, you come out, you become a part of To the Stars Academy, you bring videos along with you. I'm going to combine like 700 of the questions that I have here for time reasons. But I want to talk about that controversy. Let me ask first quickly, if I may, at what point you resigned October 4, 2017, if I remember correctly, you had submitted your resignation letter. At what point did you meet Tom DeLonge and plan to join To the Stars Academy and bring all of this information to light?
Yeah, I had made a decision to leave. Actually, I had spoke with my dear colleague and friend, Chris Mellon, and it was a soul searching moment for me. And finally, I made the decision. I said, look, you know, I can't fix this on the inside. I can't. This is Secretary Mattis is a guy that I had been in combat with, served with, and just an amazing human being. The bureaucracy, unfortunately, was such, it just wasn't getting the information to the right people. And so sometimes, you know, in a situation like that, you do what you have to do. Mm-hmm. And in order to fix the problem, I felt that I had to leave the organization because I knew they wouldn't be able to stop. The one thing they couldn't stop would be my resignation memo. And by the way, let's not forget that almost a year later to the day, Secretary Mattis did the same thing. He resigned, right? Mm-hmm. So rather than cause problems inside the system, in the Department of Defense, you know, if you can't solve it, you need to get out of the way. And you don't stay in a system that you don't agree with. If it's really problematic, then resign so the organization can continue doing what it's supposed to do, and you don't become, a friction point. Mm-hmm. That's just kind of a code of honor we have in the department. It's common. You see it in all the services. It's just what happens. As far as meeting Tom DeLonge, it wasn't until afterwards. Actually, once I resigned is when I was approached to say, hey, Lou, you know, there's this little organization over here led by some guy, some rock star, which for the record, when you're a guy like me used to living in the shadows, that's the last thing you want to do is ever be in any kind of spotlight.
Sure.
That's not our character. It's not the way we operate. But when I realized that it was Hal and Steve Justice and Chris Mallon and Jim Semivan on board, whoa, now those are people I do know. Now, don't get me wrong. Tom's a great guy, but I never knew the guy, you know, from Adam being in the intelligence community. You know, I might have been able to pick out a song, but had no idea who this guy was and really didn't pay attention to it. But when I saw who else was on and you had the advisors like Dr. Norm Kahn, and some of these other really big names that I had a chance to work with while I was in the intelligence community. Whoa, now that's significant. This guy may be a punk rocker, but he managed to get these folks together in the same room and support this cause. You know, that's a hell of an accomplishment, you know? And so I was like, wow, that's really hard to say no to. Especially when you have those people on board, and there was a lot more people that were affiliated with TTSA that's not publicly known, but again, some pretty significant people who I had the honor and pleasure to serve with back in my day in the military and Department of Defense and later on in the intelligence community. So that was really for me, I had a conversation with my wife and said, look, you know, what do you think? And, you know, she says, well, you know these people and, you know, do you trust them? And the answer is, you know, emphatically, yes, I do trust them with my life. So that was kind of an easy decision for me.
So you had known Christopher Mellon prior to resigning. It sounds like you had a conversation with him, but did not know anyone else when it came to the STARS Academy until after you resigned. And
I knew Hal Pudoff. I knew Hal. Oh, Hal had worked for me.
Sure, he was part. Yeah, and I'm sorry. Backtrack. Did you know? Did he tell you about To the Stars before you resigned?
I think it was Jim Semivan who actually said, "Hey, why don't you consider jumping on board with us?" If I remember now, don't hold me to it, but I mean, we're going back 3 years now.
Sure,
I'm pretty certain it was Jim who actually was the one to offer me a position.
Pre-resignation or post, just for chronological?
No, post.
I got you. So you...
Yeah, because I think they knew that I was going to wind up working at... You know, I got to be careful. I don't want to put a plug in for it. I was going to wind up working, you know, at a supermarket just to pay my bills afterwards because, you know, even though I had left the department, I'm not the age of retirement yet. I can't collect my pension. So, you know, I still needed employment.
Gotcha. Okay. So you joined To the Stars Academy. It all seems to happen pretty quick after you had resigned because a couple weeks go by and you're on stage.
It was very fast. Yeah, it was very fast.
Sounds like it. So, and you brought with you a couple videos. I want to focus in on that now. And then we'll get more to the DOD's reaction.
But just to be clear, I didn't actually bring those videos. That wasn't me. I did not. I facilitated the process of getting them releasable through Department of Defense channels. But I didn't actually bring them. That was somebody else.
Okay. So you had filed the paperwork, obviously.
Yes.
Okay.
I did. And by the way, after having a long discussion with my team, because I was a senior guy, I'm the one who had to request it, but it was a mutual decision that we would go. So the initial intent, John, was to have a unclassified repository, because that was my experience before when I was working in the Department of Defense, was really setting up these special enclaves where you could share very sensitive national level intelligence via what we call a terror line, and getting that information down to a level could be consumable by anybody out there that's, you know, local law enforcement, state authorities, anybody like that, that's actionable information. But it was super classified, so you have to come up with a mechanism where people who don't necessarily have a security clearance can access really, really classified information. So there's a mechanism to do that. So that kind of was my forte for some time. So we wanted to build an unclassified repository where information could be put on that was not super uber sensitive. There wasn't any like classified metadata or call signs or locational information, but we could create this database that allowed other people from the outside to look at this and say, because we went through analysis after analysis and we were still coming up with a goose egg. We had no idea what the hell these things were. And we were hoping that maybe some other people say, yeah, you know what? We picked that up too. And maybe some state authorities in, you know, Kansas said, yeah, actually, mm-hmm. we've been seeing these things over our nuclear facilities, or I'm just as an example, right? Yeah. I'm not saying just Kansas and nuclear facilities.
Sure,
I'm
just got you.
Giving it as an example.
A lot of people are going to read into that and go, Kansas, nuclear, what's
right,
going
right,
on?
Right, right. That's what I'm saying. It's anecdotal. Just yeah. right. It's anecdotal.
Okay, yeah, guys? There's going to be blogs about this in about an hour, so.
I know, God. I promise you, I don't really mean Kansas. Yeah, I'm just saying it for the conversation. But my point being is that we were trying to create an enclave that allowed us to share this information that came from U.S. government sources to a broader audience in industry. The big boys, Boeings of the world and the Raytheons, and try to get more people into the conversation, because we really had no idea what we were dealing with. And even the folks that we were working with in other agencies were scratching their head. I mean, to the point where I remember one meeting, John, we did such mental gymnastics trying to come up with, there was one particular video, I won't go into detail, but it was so, so incredible that we were doing these mental gymnastics trying to come up with a what if scenario. What technology would this have to be able to do this?
Yeah.
And it was wound up being so preposterous, so ridiculously over the top. We all just kind of looked at ourselves and said, all right, that's, there's no way that was, you know, that could be what it is. So that was, again, probably a much longer winded response that you were looking for. But that's,
no, you mentioned a video, Lou. Can you tell me what video that was?
The ones that we got released, yes. So it was.
No, the ones that you came up with the explanation not to step on you.
Oh, no, unfortunately, I cannot.
Well, I knew I'd get letters if I didn't try.
I'm no longer in the U.S. government. No, I gotcha. I have to be careful. Those, you know, I want to be very clear that, you know, it's U.S. government's business to determine what is releasable and not mine.
Okay. I gotcha.
And anything that I may have been exposed to back in ATIP, I really... until the government gives the green light, I just can't.
I just had to push you on that one. You mentioned I had to go. So let me ask you one of the few sensitive questions that I talked about in the beginning, and that is the paperwork that came out through FOIA. I went after those documents, as you know. We've talked about this privately, but I went after those documents for those listening and watching that aren't aware, and found the emails that you were sharing back and forth with what is called DOPSR, and that is the arm that essentially will authorize either public use or essentially them declassifying something, or if something's unclassified, clearing it for release, and so on, just kind of quickly summarize it. Those documents come out in the form that had already leaked in part had come out, but that was kind of re-verified on an official level. And the way you would describe the videos is what really kind of intrigues me in a way that is a big fat question mark. And that is that you describe the FLIR, the gimbal, and the GoFast as balloons, drones, and UASs. And what kind of confuses me about that is DOPSR is cleared at the top secret level. So they've got the you know, JWIC protocols to send them to, let's say, top secret data, and they review it. They can say, nope, you can't use this whatsoever. But they have those channels. I've heard, but I want to ask from you, because I don't think I've ever asked you this part before. I've only heard from others through, you know, third hand info, that you felt that you couldn't inform them properly. But again, I want to ask you this. Why were the videos described in that way, if they would be cleared at the top secret level?
Sure. So if you look at the way DOPSR works, you're actually supposed to do the request at the unclassified level. So there's several DOD instructions and and manuals, and then there's some brochures on how you're supposed to request something for publication, meaning that can be disseminated out. And that is through an unclassified document, 1910. And when you ask DOPSR, they say, please send it to us unclassified level. So we had just gotten over this awful situation with WikiLeaks, where we knew foreign adversaries were hacking our systems. That's a fact. That's not conjecture. And the U.S. government acknowledged that. And then, of course, you had insider threats, where you had, look, I don't want to get political here, but there's, you know, whether you're for or against, but folks like Private Manning, that took some very sensitive information and released it in an unauthorized manner. So because we were dealing with something that was so sensitive, and there was so few people that were read onto the program, and I couldn't even brief my boss at the time about this program, I couldn't very well brief DOPSR, who's 2 and 3 degrees removed from my own chain of command, and mention the word UFO. So the UAS, we had coined for unidentified aerial systems. Some say unmanned aerial systems, but literally a UAS is an unmanned or system that's not manned by a human being. So that's actually a legitimate term that we could use without saying UFO or UAP, knowing that the OCA, the original classification authority, who DOPSR would have to go back to anyways,
right,
to get the approval, was read onto the program and knew exactly what this was about. So a lot of people say, well, was that disingenuous? We're trying to mislead. No. Everybody knew what we were talking about, but it was a way that we could protect this from having some sort of what we call an inadvertent disclosure. This information getting out to somebody who wasn't read on, and all of a sudden now, the whole department is aware of what's going on. So that's how that, if you will, that process occurred.
Okay. So one of the other things on the same form was your intended use. Now, for those just tuning in or maybe missed the part earlier in the show, you had said you did not bring these videos out. Somebody else did. So I want to make sure that I repeat that. But internally, the paperwork showed that you only intended this for internal government use only, not intended.
Correct. Initially, that's what we wanted to create an internal enclave, unclassified. So, you know, the public we put industry partners, because that's broad enough where if you're working with the United States government in any type of capacity, you could be labeled as a type of industry partner. So whether you're local law enforcement, or your FAA, or you're one of the services, or, you know, whoever, if you're working in some sort of kind of official capacity, we wanted to give people who had certain expertise, open the aperture so we could get more scientists, more people to look at this data and help us try to figure it out.
And that was what you internally called the community of interest, right? Or COI, yeah. which
COI,
is,
yes.
Yeah, I've always, once those emails kind of revealed themselves through FOIA, I was always intrigued by that, because that sounds like, wow, why didn't they do this prior? So, you know, one would think.
Right.
So that, and by the way, I've gone after, I think I may have told you privately, but trying to find more information, if any's there, that they take that idea, because from what I've seen, when you look at these types,
there's
of
there's a lot more info, John.
Well, that's
keep plugging away.
That's
doing
what,
great.
That's what I'm going for. So, but very admirable intention there. But again, I just wanted to ask, according to the DOD, anyway, that those videos had to adhere to what was on that, what they call the DD Form 1910, which we didn't label it yet. But the DD Form 1910 was, again, for that private U.S. government use only. And when Christopher Mellon had come out recently, he had said that he supplied those videos to the New York Times, than in the James Fox's great documentary getting rave reviews around the world. James, I've known for a very long time. So quick shout out to him. Make sure you watch his new documentary called
The Phenomenon. Yeah, he did a fantastic job. He really did.
Yeah, he's a great human being. I know how much blood, sweat, and tears went into that just from knowing him personally. So my kudos to him. But in that, Christopher Mellon came out and said somebody, didn't name them, but somebody bent the rules. That was what his wording was. Which I want to juxtapose that with how we were shown the videos from To the Stars Academy. I don't expect you to speak for To the Stars. I'm not asking you to. But I do want to ask about what they called the chain of custody, because that's another one of those disconnects where paperwork says internal use only, cleared for that. Then we see the videos, and they were kind of advertised as, well, not kind of. They were advertised as going through the declassification process through DOD, and they had chain of custody documentation, and that has always confused me, because that, for me anyway, I found the DOD chain of custody forms and stuff like that. It just wouldn't apply. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
What is that chain of custody?
You know, I can't speak for Chris Mellon, and quite frankly, I've never asked Chris. I don't want to know. You know, there's, I hate to say plausible deniability is sometimes a good thing. But out of respect for Chris, I've never asked him this source, and I don't really plan to be honest with you. That's between Chris and whoever he talked to. You know, the how TTSA wound up putting them forward. I will tell you, if you were to ask me, you know, I probably would have been more hesitant to do that, but you know, it happened. And it happened without me knowing. That really was.
So you had no idea that they were going to release those videos?
Not until the New York Times article. Yeah, that was not. I was not aware.
Were you aware they had them? If I can ask that.
No. Actually, let me think. John, I don't recall. I really don't. I don't think, because I remember being very surprised because the intent originally was for a community of interest, an unclassified, but for official use only, if you will, community of interest. I wasn't the one who provided them. So I really don't know what TTSA was thinking. You probably want to talk to them. As you know, I'm no longer publicly affiliated with TTSA. They're great people. Tom's a great guy. You know, we still talk. I can't speak for TTSA.
I got you. No, I understand that and respect that. And I want to actually ask you about that, but I do want to make sure I have enough time to ask you this kind of round of questions, which is the DOD's reaction to all of this, that after you resigned, after these videos came out in the way that you did, which you've already outlined, obviously internally, this created kind of a riff. We can see that.
Oh, yeah. Hey, listen, life was very uncomfortable for Lou Elizondo for a long time.
I would imagine.
It was, well, first of all, you had the problem. Most people didn't know the program was real, so they thought Lou went, you know, deep six. Lou went crazy. And then as it started to unfold internally, they're like, oh, crap, this program was real. And, you know, we never got briefed on it because Lou was going to the much higher levels with this program. Then they got some people in there. Well, two camps. One said, oh, wow, you know what? Yeah, we better not treat Lou so harshly, because he had very, very senior people in the loop. He was actually doing his job. Then you had another faction of people saying, well, he still should have told me, so let's burn him to the ground. Let's launch an investigation. Let's pull his security clearance. And let's do everything we can to blow up his credibility. And there are still some pockets of those individuals that exist. I think that's probably why you see, you know, despite the senator and all these people coming out saying, yeah, it was real. And yeah, Lou was the guy running it. And all these obvious things that people look back and say, well, that's obvious. Back then, it wasn't.
Yeah.
And there were factions in the DOD that were not very happy with me. And those are the same factions that are still influencing some of your FOIA process, mm-hmm. where you know something exists, but they come back saying, man, nothing to see here.
Yeah.
And you might have to try 3 or 4 times before you finally get something. And you're like, you know, what the heck? How come now I'm only getting this when I requested it, you know, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
They're in a tough spot. And I don't want to disparage the DoD because I don't think we can hold accountable a few people there for that dysfunction and blame the entire department because the Department of Defense is very, very good at what it does. The acting secretary right now is a fantastic human being. The guy is a national hero. I won't go into details because you may be watching this, but the guy was there in the early days of Afghanistan. I mean, super, super person. And that is representative of most of the Department of Defense. They're good people that want to do a good job for the American people. The problem is you get some bureaucrats in there and people that are political. And, you know, there becomes an issue about ego. And just because I wasn't told about something, therefore it must not exist. Well, that's not necessarily so. And it wasn't up to me to tell, because when you look at that 2009 memo from the Senate, the access list to that program was super, super small. I can't just go out and brief somebody. I don't have the authority to do that. I get in trouble. So that created a lot of challenges for me. And you know, I often tell people, say, well, Lou, why did you just back then say A, B, and C? Well, because I made a promise to certain people, and I wasn't going to violate that trust. I knew damn well getting into this that this was going to be an uphill battle. I had probably a 5% chance of mission success, which isn't very good. Those mm-hmm. are not good odds. Don't go to Vegas with those odds. But I had a heart-to-heart with my team members, and we, in order for this topic to finally get the light that it deserved, someone had to step out. Mm-hmm. And that someone, I being a military guy, it had to be me. I was a senior guy. So,
and let me ask you, just focusing in on the DOD, what I call they took a shot at you, and I apologize if that phrasing is not appropriate. But essentially, you know, they took a shot at your credibility, and they're challenging you as a person, as a dedicated military, then later civilian employee of the Department of Defense. They are by name taking this credibility shot at you. And I will admit, when that story broke, I was surprised, despite my, again, that criticism, which you have not shied away from, that you've always spoken to me about. And I want to point out again, for those who missed it in the beginning, how admirable that is to you, because you're not afraid of these questions, nor were you privately when we chatted on the phone or through email. But when they did that, I just kind of like took a step back, and I'm like, okay, I'm not, this isn't about Luis Elizondo for me. This is about what is the truth behind what I believe is this active UFO cover-up. After they right. did that, let's zero in on the spokespeople, because they did that. We don't have to name names or make accusations, but the spokespeople did this, and they took that essential shot. Why don't you take a shot back and just say, look, here is the irrefutable proof. And let me just quickly preface why I'm asking that, is that I've seen that there are a very, and this is posted publicly, a small list of people that include a couple journalists and one UFO, what I would call like a UFO blogger in particular, that have made reference to you showing them documentation, what they call irrefutable proof that you are who you say you are. Now, I'm not challenging that. I believe that they saw something. Let me just quickly ask, yes or no, is that classified information?
It's not classified, no. Okay. But understand that I'm not going to give up the identities of other individuals just to save my skin. I've never been sure. that way. I'm not that guy. I could have settled this 3 years ago. And, you know, there, when you talk to Senator Reid himself, mm-hmm. that's for the record. He's telling you, yeah, Lou is the guy running the program. When you talk to Hal Pudoff, who was working for me, who's clearly part of ATIP, yeah, I worked for Lou. I mean, I don't need to go toe-to-toe and get into a mudslinging contest with the Pentagon when they've already flip-flopped on their position 6 times. Mm-hmm. First, they came out and said, yeah, ATIP is real, it's about UFOs, and Lou ran it. Then they came back and said, well, no, ATIP wasn't about UFOs. Then they said, well, ATIP was about UFOs, but Lou didn't run it. I mean, it's, if you look at the track record, and I know you've seen this over and over again.
Sure.
You know, my position has been consistent, and I've been backed up by everybody that needs to back me up. This isn't about Lou Elizondo. It's not about me. If I make it about Lou Elizondo, then we take away from the progress we've made. Look how far we've come in 3 years. In just 3 years, John, we have now the videos coming out that were official government videos, never before released, the acknowledgement that they're real, the acknowledgement that they are some sort of unidentified aerial phenomenon, the establishment of a UAP task force, Congress being briefed at the classified levels. By the way, if you don't think I was part of that program, how in the hell do you think I ever made it on the Hill to brief people? I mean, it's at this point, it's kind of silly, I know, and I don't need to rehash all this because we could go for half an hour, laundry list. The bottom line, John, it's not about me. I don't really care what people think about me. Never have, never will. This is about this incredible movement for transparency and real meaningful disclosure.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's more important, me going up and saying, hey, look at me, and I'm, you know, gonna go ahead and make the government look silly. No, because we still need to work with the government. If I did that, then we run the chance of just so I can go ahead and quote unquote prove who I am, which I don't need to prove anybody. I don't really give a damn what people
Sure. Yeah, I got you.
Just to prove that, I risk now putting my guys that are still there in the program, where now all of a sudden it gets shut down because it becomes too hot of a topic.
Yeah.
Now the Pentagon's getting sued by Lou Elizondo. Now there's defamation character. Now there's this. Nobody wants to touch that hot potato. Nobody does. So, and by the way, to come out and say, here's document 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it's not classified, but it's legit of what it is, with there's people on those emails that are still engaged in those efforts. And I can't compromise them. I won't do it. I never have. I never will. Mm-hmm. So until those people come out, which at some point I'm sure they will, then people come out of this document and say, oh, wow, look at that. That isn't that interesting. But until that occurs, I'm not going to do it just to save face. I'm not that guy. It never have been. I'm not going to come out there and say, ah, because this isn't about Lou. It never has been about Lou. And this is why I try to tell people, you know, people say, well, Lou's now the face of these UFOs. I'm not the face. Look in the mirror. You're the face. It's everybody out there in your audience. They're the face of this. I just happen to be one of the tools in the tool bag, like Chris Mellon and other people. But this is a long game. We are, you know, I hate to say we're in a running gun battle here, but this is a long war, not a short war. This isn't about instant gratification. This isn't about, you know, Lou going up there and making the Department of Defense look stupid. They've already put themselves in that box. I don't need to help them with that.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, what they need is a solution so they can continue to tackle this problem without people coming in and getting mad at them, because that's really what they need. And if I do anything to poke the bear, all it's going to do is make the situation worse, when really we're trying to help find a solution.
I got
you. And by the way, if it's at my expense, I'll take it, John. I'm okay with it. If the cost of us getting this far in 3 years is people saying, nah, Lou's full of it, you know what? Fine. I'll take it. Because enough people know exactly who I am and what I did. And by the way, this story is still unfolding. It's just not over. So there's a lot more to this narrative that when it comes out, people are going to go, wow, okay, that's interesting. I had no idea.
What? I only have a couple minutes left. I appreciate your time. And I want to work this in. If my audience has heard me talk about these types of issues a lot, passing it to you, if there's one thing that I haven't covered but you want to talk about or say, or a message or anything, what would that be?
You know, boy, let me say this. I believe, as dysfunctional as our family of UFO enthusiasts are, whether it's UFO Twitter or UAP research group, et cetera, we have achieved this together. And yes, even the naysayers, even those contrarians, even those skeptics, we need you. We need them all. Come on board, because this is a conversation that affects all of us, and no one owns the narrative. I'm not out pushing a book. I'm just anybody who wants to have a conversation with me can have a conversation. We are achieving this together. And that is the success here. It's not that John Greenwald is doing the FOIA or Lou Elizondo is out there doing TV shows or anybody else. It's everybody doing what they do best in this sphere that is creating this moment in time that we have never seen the likes before. We need it. And it's okay. I don't mind if I have haters. That's okay. If that's the cost of doing business, and that's the cost of doing business. The truth has nothing to fear. So I would encourage people to know that the success we are seeing right now is a result of all of our contributions, not just one person. And I think everybody plays a vital role in this. We would not be where we are today, John, if you hadn't done and are doing the things you're doing from your perspective. That, by the way, nobody's as good as doing it as you are. Just like there are certain things that I can do because of my access to help happen, and Chris Mellon, and yes, even everybody on out there in the UAP Twitter world, they're making a difference. They're campaigning. Look at Marco Rubio, when he just came out and said not too long ago, that's because people are telling him it's okay to have this conversation. We want to know. It's interesting, right? We're not going to talk about Elvis on the mothership anymore in tinfoil hats. This is a serious topic that deserves serious attention. And whether you realize it or not, John, people begin to look at you. And if you want to know what the face of disclosure looks like, you're looking at it. It's. I'm looking at it right now. You're part of that. People out there like, I got to be careful. I don't want to plug any particular people out there, but there's a huge sea of advocates out there in social media that are writing the congressman, writing the government. They're learning from you. I mean, how amazing is that, right? People are now learning from John Greenwald's playbook and FOIA, and it's working. Mm-hmm. I mean, at some point, you can't stop the tidal wave. So I guess my final thought on this would be, don't stop doing what you're doing. You don't have to be in anyone's camp. Just keep doing what you're doing. And then I would also say, beware of those selling the snake oil. Beware of those who are telling you about these preconceived narratives that they have in their mind and are saying, no, don't pay attention to those guys. That's the real threat. When someone tells you don't listen to that person, that's the real threat. I encourage you, listen to anybody and everybody you want to listen to, and then make up your own mind. That's my word of advice to anybody out there who wants to know about this topic. And by the way, no, there is no expert out there. I don't care who you are or what you say. I was in it for 10 years working for the U.S. government, and I'm not an expert. So that would be my advice to people. And by the way, when they say, well, Lou, you're pushing the threat narrative. No, I'm not. I'm pushing a narrative that they could be a threat if they wanted to be, because we don't have enough information. That's what I've always maintained. And if you think it's fear-mongering, well, then fine. I mean, if you think you have some sort of special relationship with the UFO and, you want to charge people money so they can have a, close encounter, while you're paying pilots to drop flares, okay, fine. I don't know. Do whatever you want. I think we need to have a conversation where everybody has a voice and we stop trying to mute each other. I think that's the real danger.
Those are great words. And by the way, the threat potential narrative, I have agreed since day one with you guys. As TTSA as a whole obviously has dealt with that a lot. I've done FOIA requests upon FOIA requests on that threat potential. It's very real. I don't know why people are afraid of the T word. I know I'm out of time. If I could ask you just one more question.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I want you to have the opportunity to respond, because this is all kind of unfolding right now. As you mentioned, you've decided to, as you put it, not be affiliated with TTSA, although you still have high respect for them. I've been kind of waiting. I've reached out to them, unrelated to this show, but reached out to them to get like some type of response, press release. Are they informing their investors? Only because I know my listeners and watchers want to be updated on that. So can I ask you just kind of a two-parter here? Is there a reason why you've decided to not be affiliated anymore? And the second part, which is the most important to me, is where does that leave off on the CRADA agreement with the U.S. Army, where you guys are taking pieces of UAPs that you have collected over the last couple of years, created
alleged. We don't know if they're actually. I just want to be fair, but sure. Say, oh, let's Sorry. Caveat that. You know,
yeah,
we
gotcha.
Really don't know. We want to just make. We're doing our due diligence. We're trying to find out.
Gotcha, and thank you for that. And so you've got these alleged pieces of UAP that you're going to have analyzed through this Army agreement. You're listed on there. You're the main contact. I forget what the exact wording was in the agreement. It's been a while. So that's my last question to you is, why did you choose to leave? And where does that leave us with that sure. CRADA agreement? And was there anything that transpired thus far?
Yeah. So I people are going to get mad at me for saying this. I can't speak for TTSA. I can only speak for myself. What I have mentioned before is that TTSA is a company and they owe their investors results, right? Which is all good companies should do. Be stewards of investment. Where my expertise lies, specifically me and Luis Elizondo, is not necessarily in the entertainment division, which is where TTSA does a lot of its focus areas on. And for me, my skill sets are probably better used in a different capacity. So that decision was made. I have, again, all my friends at TTSA, I love them dearly, great people, great human beings. This is battlefields evolve, battlefields change. They're not static, right? They're an evolving situation. And sometimes you have to move troops around the battlefield in order to win the battle, right? That's not uncommon. You don't just sit there in rank and file and just march forward. You have to adapt with the environment and the situation as it's evolving. And that's very much what I'm doing. This is, again, a long game. Let me remind people that, you know, we have achieved a lot in 3 years, but I think if we want to achieve more in the next 3 years, we have to adapt. We have to adapt. We have to continue moving the ball forward. And sometimes, look at a football game, right? The quarterback doesn't do the same thing every time. The quarterback's got to change plays. Otherwise, you know, the guys know what you're doing, and then they figure you out, and you lose the game. So you can't ever take for granted the battle space that we're operating in. And I say battle space because people say, oh, there's that threat narrative again. No, it's just the way I talk. I'm a military guy, right? So I look at everything as a military-style campaign or an intelligence campaign, right? It's a multi-pronged, it's a multi-dimensional battle space. I tell people, you know, there's several ways you can look at the battle space. Some people look at battle space like the game Connect Four. Some people look at the battle space like checkers. Some people look at the battle space like three-dimensional chess. And that's kind of the way I think, you know, we need to look at this. This is no different. This is a very complex, highly evolving topic where we're learning every day more and more and more. So we have to maintain our momentum by always adapting to the environment and anticipating not just the environment of tomorrow, but the environment next week, next month, next year, so we can stay ahead.
Will you?
You asked me another question. I didn't want.
Yeah. Will you stay connected with that CRADA agreement, or are you essentially out of that?
Yeah. Well. Okay. So, again, as it relates to TTSA, I can't speak about that. I can tell you that we're always looking for opportunities for new partnerships. Right. This being a perfect example, you and I having this conversation. This is a partnership. This is what it is. You know, whether you like me or hate me, or I like you or hate you, or whatever. We are working with each other because
me?
We realize. I'm sorry.
I said you hate me.
No. I'm just
kidding.
Saying.
I'm
in
just
general
kidding.
Terms. Whether we like or hate each other. No, actually, for the record, I like you, but that's inconsequential. It doesn't matter if I like you. That's my point. The point is that we each have a role to play, and we need each other if we want to continue to push the ball down the field, just like we need everybody else right now on social media in this crazy grassroots effort. We need to call it UFO Twitter, right? Or the UAP research enclave. I mean, it's working. Again, I can tell people, don't look now, but you're achieving what you're setting out to do. So I think people shouldn't be surprised if I continue to engage certain elements in the US government for the purposes of research. That's probably a no-brainer. I think most people should, if they see that, that shouldn't be a surprise.
Well, look, I can ask you questions all day. I'm down to 6,437 left to go. My guess is we're probably not in a position to ask them all right now. So tell you what, I hope that after this last hour or so that you will come back, that you will continue this conversation with me, because I hope that you've realized, not only through this last hour, but obviously we've shared a lot of conversations privately, and I hope you know where I'm coming from. And you started this with an apology to me, and I want to end it with one to you. I caught myself by critiquing the story that was coming out, then starting to shift towards it being personal, not by intent, but it came off that way. And for you, I apologize. I've already done it privately, but I want to do it publicly.
No worries, John. No worries. Listen, we're in this together, man. And this is something that I think, you know, my concern for you, my biggest concern, I've told you this privately, just having me on your show, I'm concerned that there are going to be some of your followers, fans, folks, your associates, that may criticize you for this. They may say, oh, you're drinking the Kool-Aid. You're falling for misinformation for Lou. I hope that's not the case for you. I really hope that by having this conversation together, people realize on both sides that, you know, we can work together. We should be working together. I hope this doesn't have any negative impact for you. If anybody out there is listening and they think that this is some sort of scheme you and I came up with, it's not. What you see is what you get. This is very frank. John, you did not load me with any questions beforehand. Everything you've asked me without me knowing ahead of time. So hopefully people see that level of transparency, and maybe we can show them that, you know, we all can work together.
Yeah.
We should be working together.
And I hope that this serves as an example of that. You've been so gracious with your time. I blew through the agreed amount, so I appreciate your willingness to take a little bit more time with me. You're welcome back anytime. You know my number. You know my email. Please know.
John, you got mine. Same thing. People know. Just give me a call. Give me a couple days head notice, because I do have a honey-do list I have to stay on top of. But I'm happy to have a conversation anytime. Absolutely been my honor and pleasure, and I really appreciate it. And by the way, thank you for what you do. I'm telling you, you are, and I've told people this privately, I've told them publicly, there's only one John Greenwald that can do does what you do. It's amazing what you've been able to achieve and accomplish using the government system against itself. That takes a high degree of savvy and sophistication that not everybody really understands or appreciates. I see it with you, and you play a vital role. So thank you for what you do.
Well, I appreciate that. I always love ruffling feathers wherever those feathers may lie. So thank you for that.
And you're really good at it.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that. And thanks again for your time and your graciousness. And thank you all for listening and or watching. This is John Greenwald Jr. signing off. We'll see you next time.